This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we're going to dive into the first part of a new series about efforts being made to increase media literacy on the Central Coast.
Make sure that you are consuming the media that your children are consuming. Make sure that you're aware of what they're watching on YouTube, clicking on their phones.
And later, we'll get to know more about KCBX Morning Edition host, Rachel Duchak.
Kind of nice to have that incognito thing. I like not having to get all fancy for going to work because it's just me and the microphone.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, April 29th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. April marks the anniversary of the relocation and internment of Arroyo Grande residents of Japanese descent 77 years ago. Author and historian Jim Gregory is well-versed in the sorrows and triumphs of the dramatic period in Arroyo Grande's history, a time when more than 40% of the high school student body was of Japanese ancestry. We begin today's show by revisiting an interview on the subject between Gregory and Journeys of Discovery's Tom Wilmer.
We're here with Jim Gregory, historian, author, and retired history teacher at Mission College Prep. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Tom. Good to see you.
The world turned upside down right here in Arroyo Grande on the Central Coast. Tell us about the game changer.
It would have been April of 1942, and it was the day before trout season, which is, if you're an Arroyo Grande boy, that's a date you kind of hold sacrosanct. Ken Cabarra remembered that. And Ken Cabarra was Nisei. An American-born Japanese.
Second generation.
And that would have been the day when a line of Greyhound buses appeared about 200 yards from where we're sitting up on Crown Hill to pick up the residents of the South County of Japanese descent and take them to a relocation center at the Tulare County Fairgrounds. So this was the execution of Executive Order 9066.
Let's back up and let's rewind for a moment. December 7th, 1941 was a powerful, just mind-blowing day for everybody. And for the Japanese especially, the Nisei and Issei that lived here, it must have been a doubly horrific day for them.
It was. The news would have gotten here via CBS and Bob Trout, who mispronounced Oahu as Wahoo, I think. About 11:30 in the morning. And about that time, the Aketa family, who were Methodists, would have been, like most other families in Arroyo Grande, getting ready for Sunday lunch. It would become apparent within 2 weeks that we had already taken our first casualties. There were two Arroyo Grande sailors named Jack Scruggs and Wayne Morgan, who were killed on battleship Arizona. So for Arroyo Grandians, including our Japanese neighbors, the war came very quickly and very brutally.
The Nisei that you've talked with and interviewed that lived in the South County, after Pearl Harbor, what did they think? Did they have a sense that they would be interned and bussed away?
I don't think they did at first. They were certainly anxious. I spoke at great length with Haru Hayashi, who is a longtime farmer. His father came here from Japan. Haru was a sophomore in high school. At the time of the Pearl Harbor attack, he was recovering from appendicitis and was at home. So he was very anxious about returning to school after Pearl Harbor. When he did, he didn't feel any animosity. His closest friends, Don Gullickson, John Loomis, and Gordon Bennett, they were kind of the four musketeers. And the toughest kid at Arroyo Grande Union High School was an Italian-American kid named Milt Gugia. And he came up to Haru, took him aside and says, Haru, yes? Says, if anybody calls you a Jap, let me know and I will personally beat the crap out of him. So there was, at first, there was anxiety, but there wasn't the kind of anxiety that you would have anticipated being taken away from your home and sent far across the country.
The other dynamic of the South County of the Central Coast was the number of Japanese who lived here. As I recall, close to 50% of the students at Arroyo Grande High School were Japanese. That's incredible.
That's right. 25 of the 58 members of the class of 1942 were Nisei. And what's heartbreaking to me, since I grew up here, went to school in Arroyo Grande, Grande, later taught at Rio Grande High School, I knew many of these families, the Akedas, Kabaras, Hayashis, the Fuchiwakis. But if you look in the annual from 1942, I don't recognize the surnames of many of these young people. It's estimated that fewer than half of the Japanese who were interned from Rio Grande would come back home after the war.
Interesting. And the reasons why, was there any explanation why they moved away?
Well, near the end of the war in 1945, by then many of the young people had found jobs. They could leave the internment camps. They had employment in places like Chicago, for example. My friend Ben Dowie went to University in Missouri, Kazaketa top sugar beets in New Mexico and Utah. So many of them found jobs, and there was kind of a standing invitation in 1945 from the governor of Colorado, who recognized these were model citizens. So he extended an invitation for you West Coast Japanese, if you'd like to become Coloradans, you're more than welcome, and many of them did.
One of the disconnects of this moment in time, it's been said over and over again that in many respects, the Japanese Nisei and Sensei that lived on the Central Coast were in many ways as American or more American than the Americans. They very much melted into society, baseball, and when I talk about that Americanism of the Japanese that lived here.
You cite baseball, which Japanese Americans had a passion for, and one of the great stories, one of the great families of the Rio Grande area is the Loomis family. They owned an insurance agency and a farm supply store where I bought my baby chicks when I was a little guy. But Vard was a pitcher at Stanford. He graduated, came back into the family business, and Juso Akeda, who's one of the farmers at the upper Rio Grande Valley, asked Vard if he would be interested in managing a team. And that team became the All Nisei Rio Grande Growers. And they were a terrific baseball team. Kaz Akeda, who was a catcher at Cal Poly, one of his brothers played infield at Cal Poly. They were among the team's stars. So they barnstormed throughout the Central Valley and up and down the California coast playing other Nisei teams. And they were a wonderful, wonderful team.
Talk a little bit more about the patriotic dimension of the Japanese here.
They were so completely integrated. Again, you can see that from the old high school yearbooks. They were student body officers. They were athletes, basketball, baseball, football. One of my favorite characters from the book I wrote about World War II Rio Grande was named George Nakamura. Nakamura was the sports editor of the Rio Grande Union High School newspaper, the High Chatter, and he would go on to win a Bronze Star as an Army intelligence sergeant. He would rescue an American flyer who had been shot down in the interior of China. So Nakamura was not only a brilliant young man, he was engaging, and after his death about 5 years ago, he never came back to Rio Grande, but he asked his son Gary to bring his ashes here to be buried.
Wow.
So he came home again.
That was pretty cool. Rewinding back, it's April 1942. We're in Rio Grande, and a line of Greyhound buses show up in town with United States Army, bayonets fixed. The Japanese are loaded on the buses and taken away to Manzanar, Tule Lake, and other internment camps. And all of a sudden, hundreds of Japanese citizens of the Central Coast are gone. And their farms, their farmhouses are abandoned. Two things happen, negative and positive. Tell us about that aftermath.
As tragic as the so-called evacuation of the Japanese was, there were a lot of circumstances that really make me proud to be from Rio Grande. On the day the buses left, the Rio Grande Women's Club brought box lunches to the people who were about to leave. Many farmers and neighbors came out to say goodbye. One woman remembered a string of five or six high school girls, some Nisei, some Caucasian, walking up the hill to the Crown Hill campus, holding hands and crying. Then those buses came down the hill and they went along Branch Street. So all the businesses and stores that these kids had grown up with, ending with the two churches, Methodist and Catholic, just before you get on to 101, they didn't know whether they would ever see these places again. And in fact, many of them never did. They would be taken to a temporary relocation center at the Tulare County Fairgrounds. We hear of the Japanese who slept in horse stalls at Santa Anita. San Luis Obispo County's Japanese slept in animal stalls that had been used for exhibitions during the Tulare County Fair, and they still stank of manure. They would stay there for several months, and what they would do during those 3 or 4 months at Tulare was incredible. They started a newspaper. They formed baseball and softball leagues. They started their own schools. They formed their own self-governing kind of city council. And what they achieved in that short amount of time before they were ultimately sent to their permanent camp was simply remarkable. They created a community.
Back to here in town and in the country, their farms, some of them were just getting ready to plant.
Right.
Their houses were abandoned. And there were incidents where people came and broke into their houses and stole all their belongings. Yeah. There were also touching stories. Mr. Loomis, for example, talked to us about how he stepped up to the plate.
The Loomis family, and the book I wrote about World War II is dedicated to one of the Loomises, Joe, who is a dear friend of mine growing up here. It has always been noted for its selflessness, and World War II was no exception. The Loomis brothers, who ran the family business, E.C. Loomis and son, watched over the property and the farm equipment of several families, the Fukuharas and the Akedas included. Pete Bacino, who was an insurance agent, who was tragically killed. He was a Cal Poly booster, was killed in the 1960 Toledo plane crash, took care of his Japanese customers' cars for the duration. There were others, Silveras, Phelans, Taylors. These families, to use a cliche, really stepped up to the plate and, again, watched over their neighbor's property and their equipment.
Jim Gregory, always a pleasure to visit and learn from you. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Arroyo Grande, California.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Next, we speak to the director of a documentary telling the story of the U.S. military and Lieutenant Wes Van Dorn. The 29-year-old United States Naval Academy graduate died when the helicopter he was piloting crashed off the coast of Virginia during a 2014 training exercise. An ensuing investigation uncovered a long history of negligence and institutional failings around the model of helicopter Van Dorn was piloting when he was killed and called the deadliest aircraft in the U.S. military and used on bases across California. Here's KCBX's Greta Mard in conversation with the filmmaker.
I'm here in the KCBX studio with, may I ask you to introduce yourself?
My name is Zachary Stauffer. I'm a staff producer at the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley.
And you're here in San Luis Obispo to screen your documentary at the San Luis Obispo Film Festival. By the time this airs, that will have come and gone. But we'll talk later on about where else people can see this. But so you're here to screen your film, Who Killed Lieutenant Van Dorn? Please give us a brief synopsis of what the documentary is about.
The documentary is about a 2014 naval helicopter crash that killed three people. It happened on a frigid January day off the coast of Virginia. And the pilot of that aircraft was Wes Van Dorn, a widely revered Naval Academy graduate and mentor to many, friend to many more. And his wife basically started asking questions in the aftermath of the crash as to what caused this thing to go down. She and Wes had countless dinner table conversations about issues at the squadron, problems with the helicopters, maintenance issues, and things like that. And ultimately, she gets in touch with a local reporter, spurs an investigation that formed the basis of our documentary. At the same time, one of our own at UC Berkeley knew one of the other people who died in the crash, the air crewman Brian Collins. And that got our organization, the Investigative Reporting Program, involved. And, you know, after turning over many, many stones and talking with a lot of people, we ultimately got started on this documentary film that uses that helicopter crash to ask much bigger and bigger questions about what caused it to happen, that ultimately lead to the highest levels of the Pentagon, Navy decision making, looking the other way, issues with priorities, and how our elected officials often go with what's in the best interest for themselves as well, rather than the folks on the flight line.
One of my questions is, tell us the story behind the documentary. How did you come to this story? So let's dive in that a little more. And in the effort of transparency, Jason Palladino, the associate producer, was my classmate. We were in the same class at UC Berkeley J School. So, you know, I heard about it kind of as it at the genesis of it. So just tell us some more about how you came to the story.
Yeah, Jason was a student at the Berkeley J School and came to us at the investigative reporting program for a little bit of guidance. Hey, I was at my friend's funeral, and sailors there were telling me that stuff was wrong at the squadron. I'm a journalist. I think there might be something to this. And Jason ultimately opened up a collaboration with somebody who's in the film, Mike Hixenbaugh, who was a military beat reporter at the Virginian Pilot, the paper in Norfolk. He opened up that collaboration. The IRP brought NBC News on board for a period of time. We aired about four and a half minutes on the nightly news back in February 2015, so about a year after the accident. Later that year, as Mike and Jason were both fellows at our program to dive into this story and dig a little deeper, I got involved in saying, hey, is there a film here to make? What can this helicopter tell us about the major questions about how the defense industry operates? And after 2.5 years after our first shoot, we locked picture and have the film that we're sharing here this weekend.
Okay. And so it sure is topical right now, in that with what is going on right now with the commercial aircraft, the Boeing 737 MAX 8, and how after two crashes, it's globally grounded. What are some similarities or differences between that commercial airline case and this Navy helicopter? Why hasn't this been grounded so immediately as in that case?
Yeah, the helicopter has been grounded from time to time for brief spells as there's a crash and generals and admirals want to look into the issue at hand for that particular crash. I think it's on the order of a half dozen or more times over the years that this helicopter's been in operation. But relative to the Boeing situation, I think you have powerful interests involved. You know, let's not forget Boeing is a defense contractor as well. They don't just make commercial jets. We came across a documentary film made by the BBC in the late 90s. That's actually a bit of archival film that we use in our project. That's about a wiring called Kapton wiring, and this stuff was a known safety hazard throughout aviation. In commercial and military. And it was on the helicopter that Wes Van Dorn was on and was a part of this this accident. Chafed wires and fuel tubes rubbed together and unleashed a fire. But there's an interesting scene in this documentary where the BBC reporter is talking to a Boeing lawyer about basically talking out TWA, the airline at the time, and United, about not worrying about taking this aircraft or taking this wiring off of these commercial jets. It was all over these commercial jets at the time, and Boeing said, "Nah, maybe we don't need to replace that." So there's definitely parallels. The FAA is cozy with industry, and industry has a lot of sway amongst regulatory groups and also a lot of sway in what military equipment is fielded.
Tell us the story of these helicopters.
Yeah, our film focuses on the CH-53E and MH-53E helicopters. They're basically identical aircraft, two different versions, but used by the Marines and Navy, respectively. The Marines use it for heavy lift and troop transport, and the Navy will use it to drag really heavy equipment through the water to sniff out mines that might be in a shipping channel or a port or something. And they got introduced into the fleet. The Marine version was introduced in the early 80s. The Navy version came on a few years later. And over that time, they've killed 132 people, 128 service members and four contractors in a test flight in the mid-90s. None of those accidents and deaths are the result of enemy fire. And when you look at those 132 deaths, the number of accidents that it's had relative to its flight hours, it's the deadliest aircraft in the entire military.
What was the most difficult aspect of producing the documentary? Was it getting information from the Navy or...
When it comes to Navy cooperation, we had to get information on our own. Our reporting is based on a lot of documents and data. It's based on interviews with people who were in the military at the time and former service members as well. Some analyst types who look at these issues over the long term and with a lot of context as well. But the Navy didn't want to participate in the documentary. They were involved in some incremental newspaper reporting that we did and allowed me to shoot some video for multimedia projects for the newspaper, but they were not involved in the film. They didn't want to participate and wouldn't answer questions about the big picture issues that we look into. So I would say that Navy cooperation was certainly a big challenge for us. They didn't want to participate, but we knew we had a story to tell, a true story, and we went ahead and told it anyway.
Okay. What about, were you able to talk to other service members who have flown this helicopter?
Yeah, we talked with members of the squadron, both this one in Norfolk that Wes Van Dorn and Jason's friend Brian were a part of. Several of those folks appear in the film. But we are also hearing the same kinds of stories coming out of the Marine Corps side. So we reached out to people who flew the Marine Corps version as well. So there's a lot of parallels, and we wanted to be sure to include both. We did talk with members of the squadron in background conversations as well. And on one particular weekend in which I was doing some door knocking around Norfolk to try to really make sure I was doing everything I could as a reporter to hear out multiple perspectives on the issues we were looking into. After a squadron meeting that Monday, several of them got back to me, maybe don't repeat my name to anybody else or mention that we talked. So getting the fear of talking to the press is certainly impressed upon people in uniform, and many, they're courteous about it, but don't want to get in trouble with the higher-ups, so they say their piece and quickly move on, and we keep our relationship pretty quiet. We have to be comfortable with scrutinizing some of this stuff so that the nation is better for it, so our service members are protected and safer while they do what they do. And that's not just saying, thanks for serving, let's blow up the defense budget by another $30 billion next year and another $30 billion the year after that. It's really about wrestling with the substance of what military service is all about and how we as civilians relate to it.
That was Zachary Stauffer, a filmmaker who made the documentary Who Killed Lieutenant Van Dorn? In the KCBX studios, speaking with Greta Mart. The film will screen at the Newport Film Festival in Southern California on May 1st. Visit the website www.vandornmovie.com for more screenings and information. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. We're going to take a short break. When we return, Father Ian Dellinger will get in the kitchen with KCBX Morning Edition host Rachel Duchek.
I took another class on how to make dumplings. It was a dim sum party class.
Ooh, that sounds fun.
So I learned three different dumplings, a couple of side dishes, and I think we're going to do a dumpling kind of fest.
This and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. We've been hearing more and more about the need for media literacy as a way to think critically and make sense of the media we consume on a daily basis. Today, we begin a new series on the subject with new contributor Beth Thornton. She takes us to a local community media center that's including media literacy activities along with filmmaking and production skills at their camps and youth programs.
This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas. My guest today is Courtney Fraser. Courtney is the Director of Advancement for TVSB in Santa Barbara. TVSB is a community media station that offers after-school programs and summer camps for local youth. Welcome.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you so much for having me.
TVSB has been actively teaching production skills to young people for years. Participants at your camps have access to cameras, lights, computers, and editing equipment. They even volunteer to work on the local television shows. Last summer, you started teaching media literacy, and that's what I'd like to hear more about. Before we start, let me read the definition of media literacy from the National Association for Media Literacy Education. Media literacy is the ability to access, analyze, evaluate, create, and act using all forms of communication. Courtney, tell us more about media literacy and why it has become an important part of the mission at TVSB.
Thank you for having this conversation. This is a very important conversation, especially to be having with the youth. And that's who we have geared this program around mostly at TV Santa Barbara. That definition of the ability to access, the ability to analyze, evaluate, and create is very important, especially when you see so many kids who are absorbing the media, absorbing the content. So our choice in advancing our summer camp curriculum for years. We just taught production, storyboarding, lighting, audio, which was really great. But being able to get the kids so they can analyze and understand why they're filming and recording and doing what they're doing, it was really cool to introduce to them and watch them run with it.
Can you explain the difference between being tech savvy and media literate?
You can be as technical, you know, as you want, but the literacy side, I really firmly believe that comes from a knowledge, an insight, an education,
thinking.
A critical thinking. Yeah, thank you.
What are the key elements of media literacy that you focus on?
At our summer camps, we focus mainly the advertising, persuasive advertising. We have a chapter or a morning that we talk about cyberbullying. We talk about your online footprint. And then we go into why we create film this way with this critical thinking. And that's when we start to introduce the production. So we do an activity of media literacy where we're talking about a certain idea of the day. And then we'll partner that with a production activity after we have the conversation in the morning.
Well, it makes perfect sense to talk about media literacy alongside production, especially if you're looking at camera angles or lighting. When they're behind the camera, they're making these creative decisions. Do they also do work in editing?
Yes.
So they're determining what's included and what's left out.
Yes. We have a whole day where we talk about those. They're kind of the subconscious things when you're watching media. Why is this shot at this angle? Why is this lit? How does this make you feel? What emotions are these commercials or things trying to pull out of you? So they definitely add that into their creative building through the production.
And you mentioned storyboarding.
Yes.
Do you do an activity with the kids where they actually write a script?
Well, I guess one activity we actually included in the media literacy day, we call it storyboard telephone, if that makes sense. The kids are in a group and they move sections to build on each other's storyboard. So by the end of six, you know, changes, they've created a storyboard or a full story, but they only had a portion of one square to write. So at the end, it's a group effort of creating one story. After we take that storyboard, they draw the storyboards out. And then we take those storyboards from the hand-drawn to the online, and they get to do the animated portion of it, the graphics portion of it, on the computer. From there, they present their storyboard to the team, and they present their story, and they pitch their movie. And then they take that, and that's when they go into production of the storyboard that they created. We talk a lot about the flow of an episode or the flow of a movie. We talk a lot about who is your demographic. Who is this movie going out to? Categories, for instance, of each storyboard are food, movies, television, gaming. So it's their idea of what does that mean? Who are you marketing this to? Fourth graders, fifth graders, they get it. And they come up with Fortnite commercials, peanut butter and jelly commercials, things that pertain to them. You'd be surprised what they come up with.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking with Courtney Fraser from TV Santa Barbara about adding media literacy activities to their summer and after-school youth programs. How do you teach students to differentiate between something that's meant to inform or to entertain or to sell?
We have an activity that we do with the kids, and we're teaching critical thinking. I provide everyone with the same ingredients, so everyone gets peanut butter and jelly, bread, PB, jelly. You get the choice of the type of jelly, crunchy or smooth peanut butter, wheat or white bread. You get the choice. And it's up to you to create some type of persuasive advertisement. Before we give the kids the ingredients, we watch different commercials and we talk about different keywords. The kids get to use different emotions that they pull out. They create their own product. They create their own commercial. They create their own storyboard and their own basically marketing campaign or commercial.
And so they understand that if they can come up with a marketing plan to sell something, then it clicks that other people are doing the same to them.
Yes.
And they become smarter consumers.
Yes. So then we get into the conversation about social media, and we talk about Instagram and YouTube and sponsorships and reality television. It's all right in front of their face. And once you can kind of connect those dots, you see the light bulb come on of, so for instance, the PB&J commercials. One kid put in his vlog, he did a YouTube vlog, "This show is sponsored by Jiffy."
You talked about the parents being excited about this as well. Do you have a chance to share some of these tips with them so they can reinforce media literacy at home?
So far, because this last summer was our big, big media literacy push, it was really in the explaining of the summer camp, and then when the parents dropped the kids off, and then every day I'd kind of inform the parents what we did and include that little bit of media literacy in there. The look of surprise on their face that we're having these conversations with their kids is awesome.
It's an appreciation.
Oh, it's appreciative surprise, yeah. That we've included this. They thought that they were just going to be making YouTube videos. You know, they see their kid all day saying, "Subscribe here, do this, do that." And to know that we're also adding in that awareness piece to it, they're very appreciative.
Has TVSB considered bringing this training maybe to a wider audience?
Yes. And the way that we're actually hoping to approach that this summer is by working with United Way. The United Way has a Fun in the Sun program that we work with their students, and they do the summer learning retention. So we teach the kids film and we talk about media literacy with the students, middle school, and we have a few sixth graders. And they also do a program because, like you said, you're teaching the children, but you also need to teach the adults so that when they go back home, we're still making these small corrections. They want to put together five different group sessions to talk to parents. I think it's over 600 parents from all across the county. So we're looking to help out with that.
If you could share one piece of advice for our listeners about media literacy, what would that be?
One piece of advice I would love to give, especially to adults with children, is to make sure that you are consuming the media that your children are consuming. Make sure that you're aware of what they're watching on YouTube, clicking on their phones, being involved to create a YouTube video with your kids, and just having those open-ended conversations. Step one, I really believe with all of this, is the conversation.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Get in touch with TVSB to find out more about camps and trainings and media literacy in general. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Beth Thornton.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Living in Los Osos has transformed the culinary endeavors of KCBX Morning Edition host Rachel Duchek, and it starts in her garden. Homegrown, carefully attended, and seasonally selected shape Rachel's passion for plants. Father Ian Dellinger met up with Rachel for a journey through her fog-kissed garden, to her journey from the Midwest to California, to her journey from English professor to radio host, and this, playing with food.
When I was studying for my PhD, which was in my previous life, doing literature, I did the 19th century, and I try to eat like I'm in the 19th century. So if you've squirted something out from a factory machine, it's probably not something I'm excited to eat. I like things that are coming out of the ground, that you can get from your farmer neighbor, and that are in your region, that are seasonal. I'm not trying to have strawberries right now because it's not strawberry season.
You can get them, though.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. The Central Coast is ripe with fresh produce, there is no doubt. Yet the vast majority of produce is purchased in the supermarket. Some of our own produce is picked from the fields, shipped hundreds of miles away to a warehouse, only to be shipped back to the Central Coast for sale. But not everyone buys into the corporate consumption way of stocking the kitchen. Every weekday morning, I rise to the dulcet tones of Morning Edition host Rachel Duchek. One might think that someone raised in Ohio would be grabbing most of her fresh produce from the pantry shelves, opening them up with the swift movement of the wall-mounted electric can opener, with a naughty splash of the canned juices as the only seasoning. However, her childhood proved to her that there can be too much of a good thing.
I think I might have also have to give credit to Julia Child for helping me become interested in food, because my mother was just, you know, Teflon-coated skillet, poached chicken breasts with a chaste sprinkling of lemon pepper. That's it. I'm making up for the lack of garlic now in the second part of my life.
Living in Los Osos has transformed the culinary endeavors of this English teacher come radio host, and it starts in her garden. Homegrown, carefully attended, and seasonally selected, shape Rachel's passion for plants. We're on a journey through her fog-kissed garden, to her journey from the Midwest to California, to her journey from English professor to radio host. And because she dabbled in 19th century literature, I threw in a little 19th century food-related music, the fourth movement of Schubert's Trout Quintet. No doubt, hormone-free, wild, line-caught trout. Sadly, not part of Rachel's garden, but she likes fella cuti, so that'll be in the mix.
Yeah, if I'm going to go through the trouble of making something at my own house, I want to make sure I'm using great ingredients. So we do try to get as many organic products as we can. And the best way to have inexpensive organic or almost free is to grow it yourself. Okay. So we have a lot of things happening in our yard that are a mixture of taking a cooking class on how to make dumplings and then have some of the ingredients that you would use in future when you make dumplings just out there in the yard.
And it's surprisingly, it is a clear day in Los Osos.
It's beautiful in the wintertime here. We pay for it in the summer.
Exactly.
Let's take a look outside. We're so close to the ocean. You can hear the ocean from the driveway as the surf changes. You want to pull that door? So not everything is a success. We see a dead tomato there, but artichokes coming on. And I have an herb spiral that we have out here. Sorry, the snails got to our sage. So it's not the prettiest. But we have some sage and tarragon here, where there's some marjoram. So you can just come out and trim it and I would probably not buy that from the store, but I know that I didn't spray any pesticides on it.
Is that dill or carrot tops?
It's wild anise. And we leave that here because some of the butterflies like to eat it.
Oh, okay.
So we just let this wild anise that we don't actually eat. It's like a wild fennel. We could do something with the fronds, but we'd kind of just leave it for the butterflies.
And this fennel here, do you use the seeds? I see it's all dried up and the leaves are gone.
I just am lazy. I'm a lazy gardener, so I haven't cut it back yet. We get a lot of soil from a friend of ours who used to have a microgreens company. Mm-hmm. And so we have a lot of free microgreens that come up into salads and greens and red Russian kale and Swiss chard, cilantro.
That's called voluntary, right?
In this case, we got some kind of pre-seeded soil.
Oh, okay.
And so we get some volunteers, which is always super fun. So I'm just kind of lazy in that way. This is from last year, and you just let your greens keep going, and they'll start to branch out and then have some more life.
Okay.
So by having a pesticide-free yard and learning from some friends and neighbors in the California Rare Fruit Growers Society, we get some plants from some friends there, and we have had a chance to go to their Festival of Fruit. So it makes for a really interesting way of doing edible gardening where you're getting citrus trees and interesting tomatoes, and it's really fun having a space where you can garden, even on a windowsill, with doing some greens, some herbs, especially where we live here in the Central Coast, it doesn't freeze, so you can grow year-round.
I'm not good at it. I have two brown thumbs. I've killed, in the time, that 2.5 years I've lived here, I've killed 3 things of rosemary.
That's kind of hard to kill. Do you water it too much? Do you love it to death?
Well, I've done the whole water too much, not water enough, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, you've got a lot of clover.
I always try to have something flowering in the yard for the bees, because our honeybees and other pollinators need to have flowers to eat. They need to have enough water. And I think the drought was really hard on them. And so if we keep too tidy of a yard, then there won't always be flowers for them. So I know that they like those. And so I don't let the clover go crazy everywhere it wants to go, because it would be everywhere. I try to do some targeted weeding to make sure that there's still some flowers there for the bees. Because we have butterflies and bees. We have so many ladybugs. We don't use any sprays on our yard. It took us some years to get into that balance with the biodynamic yard, but we are totally there, and you don't have to spray anything, and you have really strong plants, and it kind of helps you to prevent problems before you have them.
Rachel's garden is more than just herbs. Because of the time of year we met up, and because Rachel lives in foggy Los Osos, I was surprised to see a tomato plant.
You pretty much have the only tomato plants left on the Central Coast. Are these winter tomatoes?
These are zombie tomatoes from last year. So this is going to be like a larger yellow one. Out here, we don't get hot enough like in Paso Robles for growing like those big beefsteak tomatoes. Mm. This is the most sunny spot of my yard. So it gets full sun all day.
Full fog.
We haven't had as much fog as we used to, I have to be honest with you. So it's getting the most sun, and this is my experiment this year. My husband expanded our front yard. The fence used to go to the edge of the greenhouse there.
Okay.
And so now this is where all the free sun is.
Okay.
And so I've been trying to put as much edible stuff. When they had the Festival of Fruit here in San Luis Obispo 2 years ago, the speaker was Rosalind Creasy. And she is an advocate for edible gardening, and she lives up in Silicon Valley, so she has to be sneaky about it so people don't complain. And she's like, it's always better to say I'm sorry than to ask for permission. So it's really fun to have the tomatoes doing so well out here, and I just added like a second story because I think these are indeterminate tomato plants, and they're just going to keep going. That's a fantastic plant. And I've got these well-established zombie tomatoes for next year, so we'll be having tomatoes way before June.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
So, but yeah, there's all kinds of fun things going on in the yard. You got to protect your yard from the gophers. We have some strawberry plants, and
you need to get a cat.
We do have my neighbor's cat does a very good job with keeping the gophers under control. This is our little greenhouse. That's where I have my coffee at 3:30 in the morning, getting ready to go to work, looking at Twitter. Let's go to the back here.
Okay. Some chilies there that are bright red.
Yes. My husband likes to make a salsa. This is another tree I'd like to show you for our lemon lime pound cake. We grow the limes ourselves. So this is a bear's lime. They turn yellow when they are ready. So we've already picked a couple for making this lemon lime pound cake. And we have a lemon tree back there. Looks a little sad. I might be overwatering that one. So I am no 100% expert when it comes to gardening, but you just keep trying more and more things. And, you know, this is 2 tomato plants, and they're still covered in fruit.
Yeah.
And you don't have to just cook green tomatoes. They finished ripening up.
As we journeyed from her front yard to her backyard to her kitchen, where she was preparing a celebration meal for friends, Rachel's own journey around the globe came up.
Where did you grow up and where did your mom not teach you how to cook?
In Dayton, Ohio.
Dayton, Ohio.
Yes.
Because sometimes when I'm listening to you, I wake up to you in the morning. I've noticed a couple words, there's kind of this Great Lakes kind of tinge to it. And I don't know. I know Dayton's in Ohio, but I don't know where. Does that whole kind of Scandinavian, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan kind of accent stretch that far east?
Not really. Also spent several summers working as an outward bound instructor up in the Boundary Waters in northern Minnesota. So I think that's where I might have picked up a little bit of the Minnesota thing. So I hope it's confusing for people where is this lady coming from? So
you hope it's confusing.
I do.
It's the same for me because
you know, I spent my junior year in college at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. So I think that's another thing too. I have a literature background, and I'd like to think that's how it helps me pronounce a lot of things correctly, although I know I'm not 100%. But yeah, it's a mixture of southern Ohio down near Cincinnati area. It's in southwestern Ohio is where Dayton is. We went up to the Shakespeare Festival in Stratford, Ontario a lot. That plus going to spend some time living in Scotland.
Rachel's personal travels may have influenced her accent, but they also influenced her perspective on food, which is what our conversation was all about. As I sat and watched her move back and forth from chopping kabocha and stirring the pot on the stove, she shared how locally grown takes many different shapes.
I did a media trip to Tennessee a few years ago, and we went to a moonshine place. And it was so interesting to learn about how, from an economic perspective, the production of the grains that are from one farmer and produced, you know, and then that raw material goes to the moonshiner and does this, and then it goes over to the animals and whatnot. It was so interesting to learn about how spirits, when they're done right in a community, are like of the community, by the community, and for it. And that's why when you have like a system, like a big semi-truck comes and drops off all your factory-produced liquor or whatnot, it's a totally different sort of environment in your community. So that's another great thing about the Central Coast is I think there's a lot of interreliance here, and it's from farmers and producers and foodies. As long as we can keep looking around for what we have right here in our midst, because we, as opposed to thinking about how we have to import everything from New York or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Shifting gears, there's Rachel's career journey, from English major and teaching writing and literature at Cal Poly, to a desire to live in a beautiful location, to producing a food blog, as she chops the various vegetables from her garden and other sustainable sources.
Yes, I totally changed my career path after 2008. While my food blog did not result in me making bundles of money, it exposed me to exploring the Central Coast. So it feels like a natural fit to be broadcasting to the Central Coast and reading the local news. Yeah, it's been a bit of a stretch, but I feel like I've finally landed in just the perfect job for me because it's intellectually stimulating. I get to work on my own and challenge myself every day to try to not make mistakes. And I feel connected to the community, and I feel like I'm sharing important information.
Well, you say it's a perfect job. You get up at 3 a.m. Is that really the part of a perfect job?
I'm done with work at 9 a.m., so I have kind of the rest of the day to do. I have one other hour obligation during the day, and so that means I get to garden or take a nap or read a book or do some writing. I don't have the world's greatest social life during the week, but on the weekends I do try to celebrate with friends and stay up later and act like a normal person and then go back into the early going to sleep pattern so during the week. But it's a really fun job. I enjoy being on the radio. I like it feels like an important role.
The joke is I have a face for radio.
Uh-huh.
Do people recognize you either by your voice or by your face?
Not usually, no. Which is kind of nice to have that incognito thing. I like not having to get all fancy for going to work because it's just me and the microphone. Sometimes I wake up and my hair looks like flock of seagulls because I went to bed on wet hair. But I do have some fans and some people who I know already who are excited to see me because they feel like they spend time with me every day because they listen to me on the radio. I try to sound alert and friendly and informed, kind of keep things moving because that's what I think the morning requires. I really enjoy being in radio. It's been fun to change my career. I love having access to so much food. Here's a funny story. When I first moved here, I was living in San Luis Obispo. I went down to the farmer's market, and where I'm from, the strawberry season is 3 weeks long. It's in June, and if you miss it, you miss it. Mm-hmm. So I saw all these strawberries for sale at the farmer's market, so I bought a whole box, and I processed them, and I put them in the freezer, and then I went to the farmer's market the next week, and they still had them. I went the next month, they still had strawberries, and I said, how long is your strawberry season? And they're like, you know, many months. So it's just that adjustment between the Midwestern way of living where we have full-on winter with snow and being out here where you have wonderful food products all year round because it doesn't freeze here close to the coast. I have totally become a Californian. I love it out here.
Rachel's desire to live in the most beautiful place in the United States, the Central Coast of California, and her love for food led her to hosting NPR's Morning Edition on KCBX. On the surface, none of her history seems related. But like the zombie tomatoes, the snail chump sage, and the yellow bear's limes in her garden, her passion and her careers are all intertwined. What she can't get from her garden, she endeavors to source locally, just like the news.
The reason I like going to stores like that is that the owners have kind of vetted the food that's there. So I know that
And it's local. There's a lot of local stuff.
Mm-hmm. And so I don't have to read my labels as much. Like, can I trust what's really going on in this?
I have found that their local organic produce is no much more expensive than sanitized produce in the supermarket. Mm-hmm. I mean, I go there and I'm like, it's the same price per pound. I think I'm going to buy it here. But their variety isn't as much.
Yep.
Because they're not getting stuff that's not grown in season.
These natural food stores are dotted around the Central Coast. They can supplement your home garden, as can the local farmers' markets. With the availability of produce from these three sources, you can be assured of the local, organic, in-season produce that make living on the Central Coast, cooking on the Central Coast, eating on the Central Coast so exciting and unparalleled. I visited Rachel to learn more about subsistence gardening and to share her story with the KCBX family. What is just as important, though, is that your Morning Edition host isn't just passionate about local organic produce and nourishing the body with fruits and vegetables that are of high quality and lovingly hand-curated. Rachel has a passion for diversity, and not just diversity of diet, but diversity of cultures.
You live way out here in Los Osos, and I live in the metropolis of San Luis Obispo. So one of the problems I had of moving here, I'm really excited to live in San Luis Obispo, but the one thing that we're missing is a variety of quality ethnic food. Mm-hmm. And my favorite place to escape when I lived in the hinterlands of northwest of England was to go to London, where they have...
so much food.
London itself has the most nationalities of any city in the world.
Really?
Yeah. So you could get any type of food you wanted. And I've mostly focused on the subcontinent and Persian food and then fish and chips. But here we kind of have to either drive 4 hours north, 4 hours south, or kind of figure out how to make it ourselves.
I agree that I wish we had more options. Mm-hmm. We do have a lot of beautiful nature, and we have increasing numbers of great restaurants around here, but not as many as I would like.
Right.
And not with the diversity. So something that I've been doing in the past couple of years is exploring other cuisines and how to cook them at home. So I took a class, and I came home from a 4-hour class and I know how to make pho in a pressure cooker. So I can make pho in 2 hours. Then you learn that, oh, I have all this extra chicken for like the next dish I'm going to make. You know, I learned how to make rice paper rolls and things I've always wanted to know how to do that seems like a mystery to me from my Midwestern background. I took another class on how to make dumplings. It was a dim sum party class.
Ooh, that sounds fun.
So I learned 3 different dumplings, a couple of side dishes, and I think we're going to do a dumpling kind of fest because it's really fun to put them together, and it's just... it's demystifying. I don't speak Vietnamese. I don't speak a whole lot of Spanish, but I find that being able to dip into these recipes and different cuisines, I find myself going into the different markets. I've been into every Asian market in San Luis Obispo County that I can find. You still have to go up to the Bay Area to get a lot of things.
Just a hint, in Santa Barbara, there is an Indian market, tiny, tiny, like smaller than... it's probably the size of this house, half this house, your kitchen and your living room. And things are stacked floor to ceiling. He says, what would you like? What are you looking for? And you tell him, and it produces it. And it's not like $4,000. Mm-hmm. I was really, really impressed. And I was really excited that if I really need something for Indian cooking, because I taught myself how to cook Indian food while I was in Britain.
Cool.
Best place to learn other than India.
Uh-huh.
I only have to drive an hour and a half rather than 3.5.
Like, I've been into some of these stores up in Oakland, and I'm not even sure what I'm looking at when I go into some of these more advanced, what I would consider for myself, advanced markets.
Oakland's Chinatown is less intimidating, and my sister lives in Oakland, so I kind of, if I need 20-pound bag of sticky rice, I can get it in Oakland. But San Francisco's Chinatown, America's original Chinatown, is a bit intimidating. So we could do that as a show.
That would be super fun.
Yeah.
It's hard to get away from this area in the Central Coast because we're kind of a little bit remote, but you can get there through cooking and through exploring different markets and meeting new people and learning how to do the recipe and taking a class, inviting somebody to come over and share a meal with you. And some communities actually do it as part of a structured thing where they will focus on a particular cuisine and everybody brings something from that and then they learn more about that country. So I am all about food and openness and delicious friendship.
Food, openness, delicious friendship. Drinking coffee in her greenhouse at 3:30 in the morning as she mentally prepares to be the voice that the Central Coast wakes up to gives Rachel an openness unlike any of us will ever experience. Her love for food, distinct from gluttony, is also a love for the earth and the care of the land. It's a love for peoples of far-flung lands and friends nearby. Those are simple organic ingredients out of which delicious friendships are made. Yet another fine illustration of the value of playing with food. I'm Father Ian. This is KCPX, Central Coast Public Radio.
Listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.